Hello.
Hello.
It is, let's see, Sunday the 27th.
Yes.
And
episode 29?
Well, it would be episode 40, actually. But.
Jesus.
I think instead, I think this should be a very special episode.
Yes.
A sort of breakout Mythmakers episode with a very special guest, Mr. Hal Hefner.
Yes.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you.
So, as always, I am Eben Matthews.
He's Adam Martin.
We are M2, and what we hope will become an ongoing series is conversations with people that we are very excited to be working with and collaborating with, and building something very, very cool. So
yes.
I don't think we're going to announce what that is yet.
I was going to say, and the way we often do this, there's some really cool shit happening.
Yes,
but we can't tell you.
Yeah, exactly. To be continued. Yeah,
dangle on that thread.
Yes. But I mean, Hal is a new friend and a new collaborator, and he's very interesting guy. So I thought it'd be fun to have a conversation kind of about some of the stuff that you've done and just kind of your journey and,
cool.
and mm-hmm. You know, kind of the world of multi-platform transmedia storytelling mm-hmm. that we're all interested in and engaged with.
Yes.
Some context about, obviously, the at the moment, at least, the thing that is consuming, it's a terrible thing.
Right.
Consuming most of your time, is the consume...
Artwork.
How do you like? I was about to use the word propaganda, but that was
wrong. No, it's
good.
It is
a feel sometimes,
It is it's definitely propaganda.
Yeah. So for anyone that doesn't know, like, just give us a little snapshot and kind of a little bit of your background, and then why don't we jump right into kind of the history of that?
Cool. So my name is Hal Hefner. I'm half science fiction and half porn.
And why you don't have that
physically
on a
speaking?
T-shirt.
That's great.
My left side.
And
I think it's the bottom.
Yeah, exactly, from the bottom.
Science fiction.
For intellectual pornography. It's great.
And so, for those of you that don't know me, I'm most known for this series of artwork called Consume, which was inspired by John Carpenter's They Live, and it's basically a propaganda art series that makes fun of just the rampant materialism and consumerism and the fact that people just blindly consume anything they're told by the world at large. And so I just started making fun of a bunch of different things out there, and that artwork took off. And so it's kind of like a joke that just keeps on going and going and going. And this art has actually taken me all over the world. I've been to the Glastonbury Festival with it. I was the featured artist there in 2016. And, you know, my art...
Thank you.
And my art has been shown in galleries all over the United States and all over the internet. And I think a lot of people know my art before they know me, which mm-hmm. is kind of cool too.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to please send me money, it's hal@thecatmonkey.com. Send me some cash.
Excellent.
I'm always willing. Yeah.
I always wanted to accept.
Yeah. I'm always ready
for
to
the
accept.
Cause.
Of course.
Exactly. And so, so I'm living out in Los Angeles, just trying to make as much cool shit as possible.
Yeah.
Yes. It's great. We love the Glastonbury connection was very funny because we discovered, you know, I grew up, my dad still lives just outside Glastonbury.
Oh,
we
amazing.
Can hear the music from the Glastonbury Festival on the summer evenings from our house.
Oh,
so
amazing.
We just, you know, I used to go there all the time as a kid and
yeah.
take acid.
Yeah.
Wander around and
what else can you do, man? What else can you do there? Yeah, it was like, it was one blur that, you know, because I was there for like 8 days.
Yes.
And it was, as soon as I landed, it was like, ooh, what do I do?
Oh, yeah.
I had my pick of anything to do, so
that's
yeah.
So cool.
That's great. Yeah. I remember this very clearly when I first went there, it was like 14 or 15, and the main stage is in that kind of bowl,
yeah.
and like lights went down, I think it was The Cure was coming on to play, and
oh,
so
amazing.
Everyone awesome. Like put these big flares in the ground, which was great, these big like torches,
yep.
and then everybody lit up joints, and they yep. started handing down the rows, and because you were in this natural bowl, the air just became thick. It was suddenly this like
yeah.
pea super of pot haze.
Yeah. which was well, it was, and what was weird, too, is like... there's been a shift. Like, there wasn't a lot of pot at the
really?
Show. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Interesting.
So it's really, it was a lot of coke.
Interesting.
A lot of coke, yeah. There's a lot of coke. There's
that was
a lot
just
of,
non-existent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. MDMA.
Okay.
Molly. Also, I mean, you know, and of course acid, too.
Right.
So, yeah, so.
We're was, just not dangerous enough anymore.
Yeah. But, like, I couldn't believe it, too. And so, I mean, we struggled to get pot, and it was awful.
Right.
It was the worst fucking pot
That's
I've ever
so
smoked.
Yeah.
It was really bad. It was, so, yeah, but it ended up being I was in a haze with a good one.
Yeah, that's good.
That's a good one. Yeah, it was very with psychedelic. Your, with
now, did you have an exhibition space there? Like,
yeah, there was
work?
Basically there was a whole section with myself and a bunch of other artists, but they painted, like, the whole section was, like, in my consume red.
Nice.
And,
nice.
You know, it was right as you walked in, it was basically, you know, consume and then Banksy. Oh, and nice. So, yeah, so it was great, man. Cool. It was fucking amazing. It was
who I assume was right there to
right.
greet people.
But we didn't know. But we actually, I was able to... get some mushrooms from some of his crew.
But you never know, one of those might have been him.
Yeah, right, exactly. could be. Yeah, so yeah, funny. But it was a great time, and it was fun to just, you know, protest a lot of the horrible things that are happening in the world, right. Which is what I like to do with my art. And so sometimes subtle, sometimes not so subtle, yeah. And Consume mm-hmm. series is not so subtle at all. So
time, but it's a highly effective.
I think so. I mean, I think so. You know, it's been pretty fun.
I mean, to me, and I'm sure this, you know, as art should, speaks to different people in different ways. But right. I think, you know, to me, it's like it's the combination of what's initially almost like a parody image with and then realization of the kind of meaning behind it, which is sort of a weird double whammy in the best possible way.
Yeah, it's been interesting, and like it's led to some very serious conflicts online with people. Like, you know, I've had
interesting. Like, what kind of thing? What's
like? I actually have been. It hasn't happened in about a month or so, but usually every once in a while, a Trump supporter will threaten my life, threaten my family's life.
Interesting.
Yeah, you know, like, it's usually...
What is the
trigger?
It's fascinating. Yeah, what's the trigger there? Because it's fascinating, because the concept, the consume posters, obviously they are mocking the consumerist society we live in.
Right.
Or parodying, I should say.
Right.
But there's nothing inherently offensive in that.
Yeah. Well,
there's something to look at, but there's nothing offensive.
Well,
I think
it's like when it's combined with some of my commentary, like if I post something and I'm like, you know, fuck Trump.
Right.
Fuck Trump. Fuck all of the people that support Trump. You know,
I can see where that could be a bite for some people.
Yeah. So, you know what I mean? I don't necessarily say it like that. Maybe sometimes I do, but like, you know, I have a whole series of consume things that have, you know, they're really based on, you know, Trump.
Of course.
Right. So, and you know, they just, some can't handle it.
Yeah.
And so, like, and then I'll have, you know, some attack me for other things, like, oh, you're making fun of consumerism, but you're selling shirts? Oh, it's the irony in that. I'm like, well, look, I see the irony in it, but like, hey, if you want me to keep making this art, help me. You know, come on.
Yeah.
You know, so, but it's interesting being an artist in the modern world. You know, it's very strange at times. And it's very rewarding. And it also can beat you down pretty good, too.
Yeah.
You know, so, but it's... Yeah,
it's a hell of a roller coaster, that's
it
for
is,
sure.
Man, I mean, it is. Know. It is. I'm just grateful.
What do you say? It's been... How many years has... What? How long has this... How long have we been riding this wave?
The consume wave started in 2015, like about January of 2015, is when I put the first piece out there, which was Kim Kardashian. Right?
Yeah.
And so then a month later, I had five pieces because I just was like, oh, these are easy to do.
Right.
I can just keep cranking them out. And so I did like Ronald McDonald, Bill Cosby, Tom Brady, Steve Jobs, and then Donald Trump.
Right.
And so, and this was even before...
It's a pretty good smorgasbord,
right?
Yes, it's great. Yeah.
And that was like, and that was even before he announced his candidacy to run for president. Right.
Interesting.
And so it was like, it was perfect because growing up in New York, I had Donald Trump jammed down my throat
every fucking day on
the back pages of the Daily News, the New York Post, the TV channels, you know, Howard Stern. He was always somewhere and everybody was making fun of him. He was a joke.
Yeah. Right.
And so to see this man as the president.
He still is. It's just he's
a bad joke. But the thing is, it's like, and this is, I think, where we can look at, you know, in terms of consumerism, where reality TV has sent us astray, right?
Yes.
Where if you look at what The Apprentice did, The Apprentice took a bumbling, horrible man and put him on the precipice of being this amazing businessman, right?
Right.
Which is a complete lie, because if you look back into the history of Donald Trump,
series of catastrophic business errors he's made,
like
over
the casino. Decades. Just look at the casino, right?
Oh God, yes,
like all of New Jersey.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the podcast The Dollop? Do you know The Dollop?
No, I don't know The Dollop.
It's one of my favorite podcasts. It's like a comedy podcast. These two guys, but they did a whole like double episode on Trump.
Oh,
it was, like,
really?
Digging into. I'll send you a link to it.
Oh,
it's,
that's good.
It's
cool.
The one's hilariously funny and just heart to soul crushingly poignant.
I know. And so, like, you know, so for me, like, that, like, the rise of Trump and the rise of, like, kind of, like, the, I don't even want to use the word fake news. What it is basically lies, right?
Right.
We're in a situation now where the media is producing, you know, like, news media has always been, like, a showmanship, right?
Yes.
And there's always been an element of opinion in everything that's been done and said, and you know that there's always an agenda that's been peddled. Every intelligent person gets that, right? And so what Donald Trump is basically doing is taking this whole kind of, like, fake news thing and taking elements of what we've all known to be just how newspapers and everything else just exaggerates things to make news.
Exactly.
Yeah, right?
Yep.
And has turned it into a platform where he discredits them so that he can then tell a lie and then makes everybody that follows him believe that lie.
Right.
And it's like, it's a slippery slope of where our democracy is heading and the First Amendment and all these things. It's just not good. And so that's why I feel like I can have to continue to make the art make and create thoughtful, intelligent art that gets people to think. Sometimes it gets people to think when it's right in their face, and then sometimes you have to dig a little deeper for the message,
right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So taking a step back for a second, so you said you grew up in New York.
Yep.
What part of New York?
So I grew up in the part of New York where the last of the Mohegans took place.
Nice.
A small little town called Mohawk, New York.
Yeah.
That had, my graduating class was like about 83 people. And a lot of them were from the grade above who failed. So it was an interesting... So
that paints a picture in and of itself.
So it was a small little town that, you know, was very, very conservative, but had a lot of, you know, nice people. And I think had that really kind of like community, just, I think, like, what's the word I'm looking for? I mean, obviously community is something that I learned from them, but I think just being like kind, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for the most part, it was like, you know, community is all about being kind to your neighbors around you and stuff like that. And so there was a lot of that, but there was also a lot of gossiping and backstabbing and things like that too.
It's
inherent
in a small community.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, taking the great things that I learned from living in that small town and being, I think evolving myself from all the different political things that I had seen that I didn't like, because it was a very kind of conservative Republican town, it just allowed me to grow immensely. And so I took off, went to RIT, graduated from RIT with a degree in illustration. Then I moved out here in 99, and I've been out here making chaos ever since.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What did your parents do, if you don't mind asking?
My dad was a teacher.
Okay.
So I've been writing and drawing ever since I was a little kid, and my writing and drawing always kind of went together.
Yeah.
And I always, for me, that aspect of having your illustration tell a story, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I would always, I never always hit the deadlines that I needed to hit in school, because sometimes my art would always end up being more intricate than it needed to be, and so I'd need a little bit more time to finish it, right?
Right.
And so, like, a lot of what had happened is, as I was growing in college, they were like, look, all your art always tells a story. Like, you know, here, this is a portrait right next to it. But, like, you've done a portrait, and it's got all these crazy things happening that make me want to know more about this portrait.
Right.
And so it's like, okay, cool. I don't know why this is happening. This is just me, right?
Yeah.
That's what I do. So I took that and have really kind of, like, taken that commentary about my work to heart, and I've really tried to refine that through my art through the years. So everything I try to do in terms of whatever piece of art it is, I always like to have some kind of something where you look at it and you're like, okay, what's the story behind this?
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's deeper than just that image there. What's the story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. And that I think has a lot to do with my dad being an English teacher, you know, bringing home, all these crazy books when I was a kid, you know, allowing me to like watch all these crazy monster movies, like, right. you know, from Godzilla to Frankenstein when I was like three, right. when, you know, all the other parents would be like, you know, right. don't let your son watch this stuff. Yeah, why not? You know?
Yeah.
So, I'm so glad because I'm now that parent.
I am too.
My son's parents, like friends of his, you know, uh-huh. friends' parents, like, so Kyle was talking about this thing. Did he really see that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's the truth. And it's like, and I think, and like what I learned from my dad is like, when you shelter your child, you shut them off from what's really happening in the world, and they're not able to develop a real sense of truth and reality. And right now, I think from what I, you know, was just mentioning earlier, truth is more important than anything.
Right.
And also our personal truth. So if you allow your child to experience the world, even if they don't understand it, it doesn't matter. They're still experiencing it and later on will, you know? So mm-hmm. I think that's kind of, you know, something for me that came from having my dad being an English teacher that, you know, fed me all these books and was like, if you don't read, you're an idiot. Right. You know, if you don't know how to read and you can't spell and you can't function and you can't talk, you're not going to go anywhere in life. Yeah. You know, you won't have goals. You want to, you know, he was kind of a prick, but it was good. You know?
Yeah, no, it's good to have.
Well, and they and were they? I mean, it sounds like so, but were they supportive of the of your artistic?
Yeah,
output
yeah.
As
I mean,
well? And
my dad was definitely supportive of it. But what he always would ride my ass about is, don't just think that you're going to get a free ticket because you can draw.
Right. Yeah.
You still need to do all this other stuff. You still need to know math. You still need to know English. And I was like, okay.
Right.
I'll meet you halfway. Fuck math, but English is cool.
Right.
Yeah. So I've skated by with all that shit.
Well, especially as a storyteller, obviously. Yeah. It is, I mean, you know, there's so much to be learned from studying all these incredible stories
for
thousands of years that, you know, I think you can't, you know, it doesn't matter, like you're saying, your aunt tells a story.
Yes.
That would, I'm sure, that the impact of his education helps us a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Played a part with that, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think at an early age, my dad... He used to bring home, like, they weren't audiobooks because it was before audiobooks, but he used to...
Books on tape?
Yeah, tape, right? Where they would come and it would be, like, 10 cassette tapes.
Yes.
And he would bring those home for me all the time. And the thing that kind of changed my life was when he brought home, I think I was nine. I was nine, and it was the summer of 84 because it was the summer after Return of the Jedi had come out.
Right.
So it was kind of a lull, and for me it was like, you know, Star Wars is over, what's next?
Right.
And so there was like He-Man and G.I. Joe, but there wasn't quite this thing. I don't know how, but he saw this thing about George Lucas and how George Lucas was inspired by Joseph Campbell.
Yeah.
And my dad brought home The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Yes.
Oh, so
yes.
That was...
Oh, yeah.
So hearing that was like... You know, that...
Yeah.
Lots
of synapses firing.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And like, and that was kind of for the first time in my life that I really started to question religion and like all the things that I had been told and heard. And so here's this guy telling me that the God that I'm going to church to worship every Sunday because you're making me mom is not real, and that everybody in the rest of the world, all these other different tribes all over time, have thought of the same almost goddamn thing. So, so that kind of blew my mind as a kid. And and I think that right there, my dad being a teacher, I think that really... that propelled me to be who I am today.
Yeah,
I couldn't be there without it. And then, of course, like, though my dad was propelling me in all those other directions, he had his faults as well. He was, you know, type A alcoholic, and so there was some interesting dynamics at home. And then, on the other hand, my mom was kind of the rock that held the house together.
Right.
So without her, and her kind of, like, you know, kind of, like, shielding me from some of the shit that my dad was throwing at me that wasn't good... And always kind of being there when he wasn't, I think that, you know, helped too. And I think all in all, I think they both supported me creatively, but I think both of them didn't really quite understand what the hell I was going to do and who I was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I know my dad always liked the aspect of me being a storyteller and an artist. And I thought he knew at some point I was going to, you know, marry those together and do something epic with it. And I think my mom was just like, I just want you to make money and be able to fucking live.
Yeah, right.
That's all I'm worried about. Right. So you better learn how to do something else besides just art. And so I did. And so that's why when I came out here, I started doing graphic design work.
Yeah, yeah.
And art direction.
So that was going to be my question. Yeah. So like, what was the journey. You moved out here in 99, you said.
Yep.
So then what was the first kind of big projects you were doing?
All right. So I got out here in 99, and I had spent the whole summer of 99 before I moved out here, living in New Paltz and Poughkeepsie, that area of New York. And I was working two jobs. I worked one place at this group home for delinquent children, which was cool.
Yeah.
Right? So, and I worked nights there.
Yeah.
And so during the day, I was getting all these jobs painting murals for all these rich ladies.
Oh, right.
And I was literally living in a place that was dirt cheap a month, right? I was living with a bunch of people and I was just partying the whole time.
Yeah.
Right? But I was not spending a shit ton of money. Right. So I came out here with a good grip of cash in my pocket. And so I just, I was like, all right, I'm not going to work for a little while. I'm just going to chill.
Yeah.
So I came out here. I ended up, while I was not working, I was trying to figure out what I would do in terms of illustration.
Sure.
Right.
Because all through college, I had this false sense of security that I would be able to get out of college and get a job as an artist somewhere.
Right.
Out of staff and a full-time job, whether it's an ad agency or Disney or this or that.
Right.
And then the harsh reality set in that, there really aren't a lot of jobs for artists anymore. Right. It's really all freelance. And then I realized, holy shit, freelance is really hard, and I don't know what the hell even to do. So I learned the hard way, and I just was like, okay, I'm just going to start submitting to jobs and seeing what happens. And so I got my first gig out here was doing cartoons for the backs of Hustler, Penthouse.
Amazing.
Right? So I was drawing dirty cartoons. It was kind of like
so funny.
Kind of like the far.
This is where the pornography pot is.
Exactly, right? And my last name had Hustler. Right? So I started doing these cartoons and they were fun. And there was like, again, like the Far Side meets porn. It was really weird and shit.
Were you writing those as well?
I was writing them.
Totally your creation.
Totally my creation. I was writing them and drawing them at the same time. And so I do like, and I started off doing like five, and then the next one they were like, we loved them, they're great, here are 14 to do,
right.
But you can't use nuns, you can't use this, you can't. And so then they'd always give me more,
right?
And then they'd be like, okay, and you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do this. So I just keep painting myself into a corner.
That's
so finally
funny.
I was like, what the fuck can I do? And so this company, I don't even know if they're still in business. They were called Network Telephone Services, based out of the Valley. And they had this place called this thing called Pacific Marketing, which where they created 1-800 ads and all these kind of like sex related telephone ads and stuff like that. And so the woman there that I had been I'd been handing my artwork into this one guy, and his partner on the other side, she was a woman named Tara, and he introduced me to her, and she's like, well, I need a production artist. I'm like, oh, I can use Photoshop.
So I
luckily got into this place. I learned how to use I learned how to use Quark. I learned how to use all the desktop programs on the fly.
Yeah.
And I had like
the best way to do
it was. It was great. So I had a guy that I'm still a bunch of people that I'm still friends with today that I met there, who taught me so much about design and everything. And without them and their help, Mark Crimi and Declan Garrity are two, and Michael Burkhart, these three guys, were just fucking great to me. And so they helped me so much. And without them, I don't know where I'd be today.
Yeah.
Right.
So obviously I wasn't long for the porn industry. I couldn't handle it.
When you say production art, so like what kind of stuff are you now doing with
Photoshop? And it's funny you mentioned that. Traumatizing stuff.
Yeah.
it started off where I was really just making ads, right?
Yeah,
and I was fixing, the ads would come back with like, oh yeah, change this number, do this. So I basically started off doing production. Then they're like, you're too good, you need to do design. So then I started designing them and stuff like that. And then I became, I was very good at Photoshop, and so they were like, Hey, so there's this whole new thing happening. It's called transsexuals. Right? It's they're really hot right now. So what we need is, and you're the best at this. So we need you to go find a bunch of here's our batch of photos. We need you to go find all the guys with this skin color, and then we need you to take their dicks and put it on her. Right? So that I was like, fuck this.
That's
so I was like, I did this for about 2 days, and I was like, I just can't do this. I just can't do this. And so rather than understand that I'm, you know, a creative person and that's the problem, it's not this, I don't have anything against transsexuals. Right. I just don't want to make this.
Yeah.
I don't want to take this guy's junk and put it on her. Right? Right. And so then it got to the point where I was just like, I can't do this anymore. And so I started to be looked at as a bit of a disruption. And right. So I was like, all right, my time here is done.
Yeah.
So luckily, I met this really great guy, Michael DeLance, who used to run this, group called the Creative Group, and I went in and worked with him, and you know, sat down, took the test, and he's like, "You're pretty cool. We should hang out. Let's go get sushi, right?"
Right.
So we went and got sushi and hung out, and he's like, "All right, I'm gonna get you a job and get you the fuck out of this place, man. You're too good for this." So I leave. On the way home, he calls me on my cell phone. He's like, "Hey, I got you a job. Can you start Monday?"
I'm
like, "Yeah." Then I went and worked for an architectural firm,
cool.
And I started doing. You know, more art direction, presentations, and this is where I learned all about marketing.
Yeah.
Right? And so for the next 5 years, I worked in marketing departments for architectural firms, two of the best, Perkins & Will and Gensler.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to do so much cool stuff, and I really, you know, was able to understand marketing and what works and what doesn't and what not to do and what not to say and how to present and how to work this and that and the other. And so that really helped me.
Yeah.
And so I then returned to Michael DeLance and actually went to work for him doing creative staffing. So here I am. I'm an artist, but I've morphed into a graphic designer while still doing freelance artwork on the side. And then I go into all these marketing departments, and now I'm doing sales. Right. And what an interesting evolution, right? Because now I've basically kind of gone to art school, gone to design school. Now I'm going to learn how to sell and be in marketing. And so fast forward, I, you know, was in sales for 4 years, and I was like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
my heart's in art and my heart is in design.
Yeah.
So I ended up going and working for Ignition. Then I worked with Ridley Scott's company, 3AM, doing content strategy. So basically my version of content strategy is literally art, design, marketing, sales, all
right.
rolled into one kind of strategic game plan,
yeah.
which is what I help people do now.
Yeah.
So that pays the
right.
bills. Art pays the creative bills.
Yeah.
And then along the way, I launched a comic with a heavy metal magazine called Gates.
Yep.
I've made the Consume series, which we discussed. And I've done all sorts of other little art series too, and worked
yeah.
on all sorts of crazy, art projects. And some of them I don't get credit for because you know, they're parts of movies or other
yeah.
things like that. And so, you know, I mean, all of it's on my website and stuff, which I can show that I'm allowed to show.
Yeah.
But it's like, I mean, for me, I think the most important thing is I am where I am today, and I don't question it.
Yeah,
I've gone through a lot of stuff, but it has really helped mold me into, number one, who I am as an artist, number two, who I am as a person, and number three, it's given me all the tools that I need to do for the next phase of my career to really take off,
yeah.
and the next phase of my creative outburst
right.
to be epic.
Yeah.
yeah.
So that's what I'm
yeah.
working towards.
I mean, it's so great. And it's, you speak directly to something that I feel very strongly and kind of passionately about, which is that, you know, having also gone to art school and
yes.
graduated in the illustration department.
Yeah.
And, you know, so number one, I mean, illustration and design is supposed to be the most commercial of the, you know, the things that you can do
yes,
in art school.
Right. Yep.
And yet I think most of the time, and this is certainly true at RISD, and it sounds like it was true for you, it's
yep.
like you come out of there with like, I have this incredible like creative skill set
yeah.
and no idea what to do
exactly,
with it.
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly.
And it's like, I think, you know, that's the, one of the things I think that is neglected at most creative you know, schools is, you know, how do you now take this thing that you've learned to do and actually go make a living with it? Because nobody goes to art school to go like, hey, I want to starve and do this in my spare time.
Well, and like, I'm sure it's, you know, I'm not sure because RISD's a, you know, much more profound school than RIT, but like, I can look back at my class and I'm like one of the only ones still doing art.
Which is
crazy because some of the most talented people that I went to school with that I never thought would not be doing art are not doing art.
And it's
sad to me.
I would say most of my classmates that I know have stayed in the creative world.
Right.
But the ones that have been successful are the ones that have made similar types of jumps to be able to do a lot of different things or to be able to bring, you know, to find a way to bring their own, you know, thing forward.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of people out there working on, you know, production jobs in video games or, you know, whatever, but it's like, you know, the ones that have really stood out are the ones that have kind of been able to synergize those different skill sets that you talked about to be able to, you know, build something.
Well, I think one of the things that you mentioned, it's very true. It's like when you're in art school, you're focused on art, right? But you're not focused on all the other aspects that you need to survive, which are sales, marketing, and design. Because you're going to, no matter what, an artist is going to need to design something, whether it is a portfolio, whether it is a website, whether it is a presentation of your stuff. Yeah. You have to sell yourself, and you have to know how to sell yourself. And I think that's where a lot of schools fail. You know?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, you've had a foot in both the commercial world and in the fine arts world, which is also somewhat rare, I think. And it was profound to me when I was in school. One of my mentors is a guy named Alan Rheingold, who's a movie poster artist and, you know, pretty well-known illustrator.
Right.
But he, you know, he was the first one that ever said to me, you know, hey, like, you know, people think that actually being a successful illustrator is different than being a successful fine artist. Yeah. And yes, they're two different games, but it's still about sales and marketing and getting in front of people and knowing how to talk to people. And it's like, you know, two different worlds, but the same skill sets apply, you know, in both arenas.
Yep.
And I also like what you said. I think it's very interesting that you don't get to choose your journey.
Yes.
And so the fact that you moved out here with this degree that then and then did were running kind of pornographic cartoons for a couple of years. Yeah. Going over here doing this. Yeah. Like, and then that's what led you to this place where, you know, now the kind of, you know, father of this massively, you know, kind of pop cultural phenomenon that consumes here is.
Yeah.
Like, you would never have predicted that, and yet, as you were saying, it's all these things that you did along the way allowed you to come to this place and do this thing. Which because it's crucial to hear.
It is. I wouldn't have been able to have made the Consume series had I not learned graphic design.
Right, of course. Yeah.
Because the whole element of, yes, I understood color theory because of art school, but applying it to design, using the right typography, understanding, like, you know, when people will look at my stuff and they're like, oh, this is like Shepard Fairey. It's like, no, this is actually more inspired by Barbara Kruger.
Right.
You know, and it's, and like, if you look here, like, this red is Barbara Kruger red. This, you know, and I'm, and I'm just kind of like, I'm parodying a lot of things and pulling a lot of things in. And so, but like, understanding different disciplines is so important. And I that's why, like, I'm always open to, like, if somebody ever comes to me for advice, I always try to give advice. I mean, and that goes back to being my dad. You know, my dad was always, like, very open to helping people, especially kids, you know, because when you're a kid, man, you don't know what you're doing. You know, so if I can help anybody not make the same mistakes I made, let them make their own, you know, I'd be more than happy to lend, you know, to listen and help anybody that I could.
Well, and it also sounds like, you know, you have a lens through which you kind of view that journey, which is actually, you know, resonates with me because it's similar to the way I look at my own life and careers. It's like, you never know how all those dots or threads are going to connect until you have hindsight to look at them. And then if you're looking through that lens or through that point of view, they actually do all connect. It's always amazing how you go like, this thing that I hated at this particular time, you know, actually allowed me to do this thing that I love. Because I had that experience or learned something from it or, you know, whatever.
And as I got older too, like I've, you know, kind of you slow that thinking down a little too, yeah. You know, because you're like, and I mean, still as parents and things like that, we're still constantly like going, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we're running, and sometimes it's hard to stop and look and reflect. And so I think one of the things that has helped me a lot too is a little bit of meditation.
Yeah.
Yes. I started meditating and it's like, it's made such a difference. It's allowed me to slow it all down. It's allowed me to really be grateful for a lot of the things that I have, and it's allowed me to realize that what I want and what I, you know, desire can happen. Yeah, and it's right. Like, and the proof is in everything that's happened thus far, because I've wanted to get to this point and it's helped me get to this point, and I've brought those things into my life to get to this point. And so it's like, no matter how down you feel or how much of a failure you feel like, there's always tomorrow and you always have to keep going. And the more positive you are and the more you can, you know, set these goals and slowly achieve them or quickly achieve them, the better you are.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, it's something I think we try to stay cognizant of too. And I think sort of philosophical, you know, approach to life, at least, you know, certainly for me. And I think sounds like for, I'm pretty sure for Adam, and I think for you as well, is, you know, it's like the concept of, you know, it's like you can see the thing that you want, and a lot of people get stuck by, I don't see how I'm going to get there. Like, right. I see this thing that I want. I don't know what the steps are to get there.
Right.
And therefore, I do nothing.
It's, right.
It's the trap a lot of people, I think, fall into. Yes. When I think the only way you ever get that thing you want is you just take the first action.
You
and
do.
Then the next thing presents itself.
Yeah.
And you take the next action.
Exactly.
And the next thing presents itself. Mm-hmm. And it's just that, you know, that willingness to kind of step off the cliff and, you know, find the next piece of footing.
Well, just get out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Because anything that's worth anything is going to make you feel uncomfortable to take that leap to go do it in the first place, right? Whether it's searching for a knowledge, whether it's searching for, you know, the information that you need to get you to where you need to go to talk to this person that's going to help you do this, or even to just talk to this person, you're afraid to do it.
Yeah.
And most of the time what we're afraid of are the things that we need to conquer, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
So like, you know, and you fear most what you know you need to do, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, kind of just sucking it up and realizing that, you know, these were some of the things holding me back and that I just needed to push forward.
Yeah.
I think was a huge, kind of huge force in unleashing the Consume series, because like I said, that wasn't the intended thing that I needed to do.
Right.
But like the Consume series being alive and being out there is what's going to allow me to do all these new things that I'm working on now.
Yeah.
So,
no, it's cool.
So yeah, it's, I'm very blessed.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm very
awesome.
Humble.
So, a quick sideline, just because this is one of the things that I am fascinated by, and I think you know, it's just the way that my brain works, and so I like talking to other people whose brain seems to work sort of like this way as well. So when it comes to like storytelling and constructing, you know, narratives, or you know, kind of the things you've done with other companies,
right?
Whether people call that transmedia or multi-platform or whatever, it's like how do you feel like you find your way into that world, or how do you tend to work with other people to kind of figure out what those components are and how they kind of fit together and become something?
For me, I think it's a matter of, and this is, I can thank Chris Ironman for this. Chris is a guy who is like just brilliant. He's a real, really intelligent guy who is, you know, just wise beyond his years. And is like in his early 30s, but has done so much epic work.
Yeah.
And I got to work with him at Ignition, and I got to work with him at Ridley Scott's company. And one of the things that he kind of ingrained into me that I may have missed over the years, and I think was one of the things that I had, that in terms of being a good storyteller where I had failed, is I was so focused on, you know, this kind of like transmedia stuff, all the little elements that surrounded the major narrative, that I sometimes lost sight of what he would call an organizing idea.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, and once that really set in, like, what is this organizing idea that dictates the entire campaign, that dictates the entire kind of like, you know, the entire universe that your story is based on? Without that organizing idea, you pull it out and everything falls to pieces, right?
Yeah.
And so many things out there don't have an organizing idea, and a lot of them that don't fail, right?
Yeah.
some of the best pieces of you know, foundational content have a great organizing idea. Like Star Wars, you know, for example, right? It's all about, you know, the farm boy that can, you know, do anything. He just puts his mind to it, right? I mean, if you break it down, it's like, you know, and from these ideas, the whole everything unfolds. And so for me, the most important thing for any content strategy or any campaign that I do is really identifying that organizing idea. And it's very hard to do. It can be the hardest thing to do because you have all these different wonderful pieces of narrative that you want to play in, and sometimes those pieces of narrative mask themselves as the organizing idea, but they're not. So you have to dig deep, and what Chris taught me was that no matter how deep I've dug, I can always dig deeper. And so I, you know, from him, I've really learned how to put narratives together and use an organizing idea. And so since I originally started conceiving some of my own work to where it is now, now I'm really, you know, ready to inject and build upon my own organizing ideas. And so it's kind of, I mean, I think that's right then and there. If you don't have an organizing idea, your content's going to fall apart.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think that's such a great way to put it. And it's actually a much more succinct way of putting it than I think I've heard many other people say, because I think, you know, we've talked about before, it's like, you know, we've been having sort of multi-platform conversations with people for, you know, almost a decade at this point. And it's just within the last few years that we think, you know, we've found that other people are sort of talking the same language in a way that they hadn't been previously.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is that it's like, you know, people have not noticed or haven't really been able to wrap their heads around, like, how do you formulate and organize these different things to make something that feels cohesive as opposed to
I think it's also an extension of something we talked about earlier, which was the Seth and Evan thing about the story versus the plot.
Yeah.
And so when you have a fundamental understanding of what the story is you are telling on a base level, then the plot can become the details around all the devices around that.
Yes.
So, you know, you've got that kind of cornerstone of your structure in place. Everything else can build on on that strong foundation and tie into that foundation the way that otherwise you're just building all these peripheral pieces without that, and that's where, you know, the second someone pokes a hole in it, it falls apart.
And in all honesty too, what I've noticed, especially over the last kind of like couple of months, like as I've started to organize a project that I won't mention, that I've started to kind of like put together, it's like in different stages of creation, I didn't have that organizing idea. I had the world, but like, what's the organizing idea? And so as things change and you enhance a story, like, it's always good to go back and refine that organizing idea so that you can then allow everything to trickle from it. Because as soon as you have one element that does not make sense within that, you know, the confines of what, you know, that organizing idea was trumpeting out in the first place, everything unravels.
Yeah.
And you get stuff that sucks. Yeah. You know, and you...
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we always talk about, you know, kind of creative...
Yes.
We always, you know, we try to talk about, like, our own creative process and this creative process in general.
Yeah.
And, you know, what that also makes me think of is one of the other things I'm always kind of interested in is sort of the macro to the micro.
Right.
It's like, so I think, you know, that actually applies from the kind of macro conception of the thing itself down to the smallest pieces as well. So it's like, anytime we find ourselves with kind of quote unquote writer's block, like, I don't actually think writer's block is a real thing. I think it's a failure of that organizing idea. It's not finding the thing that makes everything make sense.
Yeah.
And so it's like, for us, it's like anytime we're stuck in a script, it's like we can kind of talk through it and find, like, oh, well, actually, this is the piece that's not working.
Right,
it doesn't make sense.
Yep.
And as soon as that's unraveled, it's just like boom, 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 boom. Everything falls into place.
Yes.
And you kind of know you've
And sometimes it's frustrating because you think you're pulling one thread and it does unravel the entire sleeve of the gun.
Right.
But it's worth doing that work to end up with a strong end result as opposed to just try and patch it up and hope that nobody notices.
Yeah.
Because inevitably they do.
Yes, inevitably they do. Yeah. And there's things that don't work often are
a result of
those things.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And brand, and I think the same also goes for brands. Like brand strategy is very similar. If your brand, if you don't have like a strong brand identity and the principles of your brand are not out lined, then like anything you say and do is all just doesn't work, right? You just have to understand who your brand is and your brand voice and all that stuff in order for your brand to work. And I think a lot of companies are failing.
Well, I mean, it's like great branding is great storytelling in a lot of ways. Absolutely. So it's like, you know, I mean, even, you know, I'm a unabashed kind of Apple fan, but it's like Apple does a great job of telling a particular story. And, you know, one of the reasons I think that, you know, Android doesn't work as well is they don't have a cohesive story. They don't have a cohesive brand. So it's, you know, it's that, you know, it's fundamental. You know, I think storytelling in general is kind of fundamental to everything. And then just how you apply it gets you different results.
No, absolutely.
It's absolutely right.
Yeah, definitely. It's brilliant. And also, just sorry, as a side note, so 2 years ago, my wife had been going on about me meditating for a long time.
Oh, nice.
And then 2 years, she was like, you should meditate. I was like, I'll get to it. And then finally, she's like, I bought you a meditation course.
Oh, really?
And so I've been doing TM for the last two, Transcendental, for the last 2 years.
Nice.
It's changed my life. I really love it. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you follow a specific one?
I started doing Raja Yoga.
Okay.
And so I had gone to a yogi about 10 years ago for about a year. And then they moved the group to Gardena, and I didn't want to go to Gardena.
No,
so I was like, So I just started, so I actually stopped meditating for a while. And I recently found it again because I needed it. And so I, you know, and I was like, oh man, this stuff's powerful. Why did I stop? Why did I stop? So now, so now I'm on a good path again, and I'm doing it twice a day. Doing the, you know, the basically... and of course, today I didn't do my morning meditation, but I did work out. I did that. But yeah, it's a combination of exercise and meditation that kind of helps me get out of the flow, and it just breaks it up. You know what I mean? Exactly. It breaks it up and it allows you. And what I found is like a lot of people they're like they go into meditation like I can't clear my mind. I can't clear my mind. It's like
that's the point.
It's like it's like you're. Clearing your mind means you're thinking of stuff. And you just have to cycle through and clean all that shit out.
Right.
Stay with it long enough to realize that, okay, after I've stopped thinking, there's nothing to think about. Now I'm going to focus on the meditation. And it just happens, And so, you know, for me, it takes about 15 to 20 minutes to kind of get into the meditation. And then, but then there are some times when I can just sit down and, like, my mind is cleared and, bam, I'm right in. You know, so, but, like, it's helped me tremendously. And I hope to be able to do it the rest of my life, you know.
No, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. It's good stuff.
Very cool.
Brilliant.
Very cool.
So something we like to do then at the end of our podcast is the Hujima flip of the week. We haven't prepared you for this in the slightest.
So why don't you explain what is
the Hujima flip is simply a word that I started using when I can't remember what I want to be describing. Like, you know, the Hujima flip.
What should we call it, right?
So we tend to try and do something. It's, you know, normally obviously it's what we've seen, what we've been thinking about this week, whatever.
Kind of
else.
Top of mind for the week.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
For
me, it was last weekend. We went and saw 2001. I took the kids to 2001 on a big screen, and I had only ever seen it on a television. Like many people, and one of the joys of being in LA was going to the Cinerama Dome, seeing a brand new 70mm print of this movie. In the original stereo thing, with an overture, with an intermission, and then having Chris Nolan, who had supervised the production, come out and introduce the movie.
Amazing.
Which, you know, it's very rare that I get starstruck, but I think I would be a little bit starstruck meeting him.
Yeah.
And my son, who was there, my 10-year-old was there, did get to, like, ran into him in the loo, which was great. At the intermission.
Amazing.
And seeing that again was just... I did realize that there are some, it's very ponderous at points, and the ending is very self-indulgent, and there is truly some spectacular filmmaking there. There is still, you know, I can occasionally get lost in the, you know, especially I think being involved for so long behind the camera, there's very little visual trickery that I don't look at and like, oh yeah, I kind of know how they did that. And there are repeated shots in that film. Like, I have no idea how the fuck they did that thing. That is amazing. Yeah. And it's 50 years old.
Pre-CG.
And it's still amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the apes at the beginning and the first kind of smashing. I mean, it's just spectacular. So that was very definitely, having not seen that in probably 20 years, I was blown away by that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see that piece of art that I did based on 2001?
No, what?
Hang on.
Wait.
Dun, dun, dun.
Let's see.
Here, I'll talk about mine.
You'll dig it.
Pulling this up. So, so actually, relevant to our conversation, one thing that I've been listening to this week is a podcast called 3-Point Perspective. It's a podcast by three illustrators. It's a new show, so I think they're on episode 3 right now.
Oh, cool.
But Jake Parker is the guy that I was familiar with, him and two of his friends. So mm-hmm. Jake Parker's a pretty well-known, independent comic artist, illustrator, picture book illustrator. It's kind of amassed a pretty huge following online.
Oh, pausing. Yes.
Nice. Fantastic.
Oh, that's brilliant. That was exactly...
The iPhone has obelisk.
Yeah, that's great. Very nice. Yes.
So the show, 3-Point Perspective, what they do every week is they kind of tackle a particular illustration related, and I think even more appreciated to me is given our conversation is kind of illustration business related conversation. And so you're kind of getting three different people's perspective, but all three of them have over 25 years of experience in the illustration world.
Nice.
They've worked for every major publisher out there. They've kind of all taught at university level. And so it's an interesting conversation every week about self-promotion or, the last conversation is about, should you do fan art, which is kind of an interesting
topic. Oh, that's
fun.
Right. Interesting.
So I've been enjoying that show, and for anyone that's sort of, interested in that world, it's a good one.
Yeah, and that question is one that I struggle with every day. Because, I hate doing fan art, but fan art is, to me, it's marketing.
Yeah,
right. That is my marketing because I can do all the cool art that I want, but it doesn't get the pull and sharing that the fan art does.
Yeah,
and so that's awesome. And so I tend to do a lot of fan art to help kind of get my name out there.
Yeah, nice. Exactly. Well, I mean, very much what they were talking about is the kind of clickbait of fan art versus and versus the convention scene where that's the stuff that will sell, but then there are some kind of gray areas legally around it. And mm-hmm. it's a lot of angles to kind of that particular question.
Nice. Yep. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cool.
So yeah. So then yours.
All right. So I'll say, because it's fresh on my mind and we talked about it earlier. Solo. So I went and saw Solo on Friday night with a bunch of friends, and what I've realized is Star Wars is dead as I once knew it. No, I mean, Star Wars always has this wonderful place in everybody's heart, right? And I think what we're seeing now is we're seeing all this new content come out, and not all of it's good.
Yeah.
And not all of it is as genuine or wonderful as we'd like it to be. But what we see is we see a lot of fanboys still apologizing for not liking the film. And I've seen a lot of reviews that are like, well, it sucked, it was this, it was that, it was this, but it was a great film! And it was like,
right, yeah.
You can't have both, you can't take it both ways,
yes,
right?
Yes, totally agree.
And and I've seen a lot of my friends who are diehard Star Wars fans that I know as also love good films cannot like this movie.
Right,
right.
And for the same reasons that I don't. But basically, in a nutshell, if I had to describe Solo, it's kind of like that Saturday night, you went out, you got really drunk, you met somebody, you had sex, you woke up the next day, and you knew you had sex, but you were too drunk to kind of remember if it felt good or not, right? Solo's kind of like that. It leaves you with this, okay, it was a film. It's not really great. Like you were mentioning earlier, there's no consequences because the characters don't die because they live
there's
on.
No stakes. In
which
there,
is always a problem with prequels. And I just feel like this was a fan service jerk-off session.
Yeah.
And I did, and I thought the story was lazy.
Not especially good.
No.
I think part of it, and this is, the little bit of lore around this that I know, which is known by the internet, so
you take that
for what it's worth, But apparently, they were really trying to get Lawrence Kasdan to do another Star Wars movie. He didn't really want to do another Star Wars movie.
Interesting.
They offered him Young Han Solo, and he was like, oh, I would do that, because he's had some picture on it. And so that's kind of why this movie got greenlit, was like, oh, this is how we
Larry
can get
Kasdan.
Him to write
There are worse reasons.
There are.
Absolutely. But
overall, I mean, I think as a whole Star Wars movie, to me, it's even worse than Attack of the Clones. And it's to me, it symbolizes a very corporatization and is the real Disney stamp we've all feared. Because it was watered down, dumbed down, every type of cliche that you could possibly think of to describe, like, Michael Bay's filmmaking. It, to me, it was all...
Without any of the visual swagger that Bay brings.
I know. Yeah. I didn't expect much going in, and I didn't get much going out. So it was fine.
Sorry, we're recording outside today, so a few things going around in the background.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, we were talking about this earlier, and I think, you know, we all kind of had similar takes on it.
Yep.
I am definitely the Star Wars apologist of the group. in fact, you can find a 2-hour Last Jedi
diatribe
for me, although it was a extended one. My first viewing of Last Jedi, I really didn't like it. My second viewing, I found it actually pretty fantastic, but that's a whole other
conversation. Yes. Exactly. Yep.
I fear that will not be the case with this film.
No,
but
does.
Anyhow, yeah. So, Hal, thank you.
Yeah, no
so
worries.
Much
thank you guys for having me here.
Woohoo! Exactly. There'll be lots more to come, and something pretty spectacular.
Some
to
very
announce
cool stuff coming out in the next
in short
little
order.
Bit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fantastic. Brilliant.
Have a great week.
Cheers, everyone.
Cheers.
Bye.
Hey, this is Eben again. So just back with a little outro. I'm sure you picked up on the background outside noise throughout that whole episode and conversation with Hal. So we were out in the wild for that one, but I just wanted to follow up realizing that we forgot to give you any information where to find out more about Hal and just where to connect with all of us. So as always, for us, you can find us on all the social media places at M2Action. You can download the Macroverse app, our vision for the future of comics and our kind of innovative digital comics platform at macroverse.media, or just find it on the App Store or Google Play. As a side note, episode 8 of Dead Town just launched yesterday, so go check that out. We're very excited about it. It's very cool and introduces a very interesting new angle on what we're doing there. So I also wanted to give you some information about Hal as far as where to find more of his work. You can find him on Instagram at Hal Hefner, and that's HALHEFNER. I guess, as he said, part robot, part porn star, Hal Hefner. And then he's also got his own website, portfolio site, which is halhefner.com. He's on DeviantArt, he's on Facebook. You know, you can definitely find him and his work on the web. He also has a studio and production company called Cat Monkey, so you can find that via those other spots as well. So please check out more of what he's doing. We're very excited about the project that we're developing together. We will see you on the web, and we'll be back next week. Thanks again, everybody. Have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.